Yeah.
All right. So, thank you for inviting me. I'm Dr. Terry Walls, and I'll be talking with you about food and brain health. And how I'm going to do that is in the context of what's happened to me in my observations of the literature. First thing foremost, I have to put out a disclosure that the FDA has not approved any of the statements I made in my books, on my website, or any of my lectures. And my statements are not intended to diagnose or treat any medical diagnosis because only an FDA-approved medicine and device can make such a claim. The Walls way, the Walls diet that I'll talk about, recommends 9 or more cups of fruits and vegetables, which is more than what the American Dietetics Association recommends because they talk about 5 to 9. Having said that, let's get down to how I view the world. This is a wonderful model of a more holistic look at health and disease. Conventional medicine, which is what I was trained in, is the top half of the tree. When the physiology gets screwed up, symptoms occur in a variety of organ systems, and I've learned how to diagnose those and treat those symptoms. And during my basic science years, I learned a whole lot about physiology, which is in the roots of the tree, and how to, what would influence those. But during my training, we fell away from the basic sciences and focused primarily on the organs and controlling symptoms. The interventions that I used to recover, and the interventions I use now in my own clinical practice, focus much more on what's broken in the physiology and how I can improve that. And food is often a very key part. Okay, so here's my story. October of 2007, I was in a wheelchair. I have secondary progressive MS. That's generally refractory to treatment, as it was in my case. I'd spent 4 years in a tilt-reclined wheelchair. Sitting in a desk like you are would have exhausted me within 10 minutes. I could walk short distances using 2 canes. And I knew that I would be spending more and more of my time fully horizontal. The VA and the university had redesigned my job many times. They'd gotten me this wonderful zero-grav chair so I could work essentially reclining. And so we have a case report of somebody with secondary progressive MS. I'll tell you how I use my interventions and what we can do. So this is medical jargon, basically saying, yep, I was diagnosed definitively. In 2003, I needed a tilt-reclined wheelchair. I took some chemotherapy, didn't do much. I started on Cellcept, which is a transplant drug, which also didn't do a whole lot. But on the other hand, the most you can hope for with those drugs is just slowing the decline. None of them would get a return of function. This tells you how ill I was. I've been getting steadily worse. It was a NARCOM's quality of life survey where you answer questions. What were your MS symptoms like in the previous 6 months? How bad is your fatigue? And how well you can get along? The bottom line here was that for the prior 2 years, I was getting steadily worse. You just don't get better. We don't know why the brain is shrinking. There's no new acute lesions, but you're steadily getting more and more disabled. In desperation, decided to take matters in my own hands and went back to studying basic physiology in the brain and decided that I was going to redesign my nutrition so that I could reduce inflammation as best I could through diet and make sure I was eating all the building blocks that my brains and muscles would need. This is just a bunch of research that tells you exercising is very protective because it produces something called nerve growth factors in the brain. And without these nerve growth factors, our brain cells will begin to shrivel and die. That is part of the reason why exercise is so therapeutic and so helpful in many mental health states. Because that exercise stimulates these nerve growth factors which help support all those brain cells, including those in our frontal lobes that are so important in how we think and have judgment. Neuromuscular stimulation is like a TENS unit, slightly different frequencies. It's been used to stimulate muscles for athletes. The East Germans and the Russians first used this for the Olympians. Then athletes around the world began using it. More recently, it's been used in cerebral palsy and strokes. So I requested a trial of that for my physical therapist, who said, you know what, that hurts a lot. It's exhausting to athletes. I really don't know that it's going to be helpful to you. But he did agree to let me have a test session. Now, at that same time, I had gone back to my physiology text, brain stuff, all that stuff, and decided I was going to redesign my diet so that everything I ate was good for my brain. And I wanted to support my mitochondria. Now, these are some pictures of corn and lettuce plants. The corn and lettuce plants on the left have all the nutrients that they need to grow. The plants on the right have everything but sulfur. So they're a little short on sulfur, and they're stickly and stunted. And this is a great study. I'd recommend you look at it. Just the pictures are really cool. Weston Price, 1936, took a multidisciplinary team around the globe looking at the food intake of primitive peoples and did dental exams, physical exams, mental health exams. And he analyzed the data based on were these people eating their primitive diet, their first-generation Western diet, or second-generation Western diet. He's looking at Aborigines, Africans, Inuits, remote Andes, very disparate individuals. And what they saw, the primitive diet, they had very different foodstuffs. The Eskimos ate mostly, nearly entirely meat, fish, and only a few vegetables. Yet other cultures that ate no meat whatsoever. But the local individuals had adapted their foodstuffs to maximize their nutrients. And they were the primitive diets were remarkably similar in the water-soluble, fat-soluble vitamin intake, the essential minerals, and essential fats. The westernized diet was also remarkably similar. It was something that we all recognize, white flour, sugar, white potatoes, meat, and very few fruits or vegetables. And so they had a much lower vitamin, mineral, essential fat content. And so the primitive diet, they had healthy, straight teeth, little chronic disease. The westernized diet had crooked, rotten teeth, and much more mental health problems, much more chronic disease problems. This is a great photograph taken from that book. So you can see, you eat well, you got straight teeth. You eat white flour and sugar, you have missing teeth, and the ones that are there are crooked. Okay, now this is just some reference that there are a number of studies now that have taken people, primitive folks who've adopted the westernized diet, who now have diabetes, heart disease, other bad stuff, send them back to follow their original primitive diet. No more direction than that. And they had improvement in their molecules or biomarkers for chronic disease, diabetes, lipids, etc. So, you know, the bottom line is, from what we know in nutrition, we can eat lots of things and be healthy. But the one thing that we repeatedly have shown us that we are not healthy on is grain, white flour, and sugar. We have several studies that have looked at the nutritional intake of Americans. This was from 2005. The key point from this slide is that this is the percentage of people who are older than two who fail to eat through their food or their vitamins enough of their B vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, essential fats, and essential minerals. It's estimated that 90% of Americans, we are starving for micronutrients. Those B vitamins are critical for making neurotransmitters. Those B vitamins are critical for making myelin. And if you can't make neurotransmitters and myelin, your brain doesn't work very well. It shows up with a whole host of problems, be it psychological problems, or early dementia, learning disabilities, or in my case, MS. So my first intervention was I moved to the Paleolithic diet. I increased vegetables and fruit, and I decreased my grains and dairy. And then I got down to looking at, okay, so what do you need to make myelin? And I knew about omega-3 fats, but you also need thiamine, folate, and B12, and minerals, particularly iodine. And most islands, we don't eat fish, we certainly don't eat seaweed. And I had been following my physician's advice, quit using all that table salt, because salt causes high blood pressure. Well, the problem is, our soil is iodine depleted, and iodized salt is how we get our iodine. So, over the last 20 years, Americans have decreased the consumption of iodized salt. The salt that's put in our processed food is not iodized. So we've become steadily more iodine deficient. Now that will show up as increased fibrocystic disease, infertility, and it will also show up with problems with myelination. Our grains don't do quite as well. We'll talk about what you can do to help that out. And then there's the question of, how much do you need for your vitamins? Now forgive me, this may be a little bit technical. SNPs are single nucleotide polymorphism. Now each one of us have a unique set of DNA from mom and dad, and a unique combination, unless you have twins. You're unique. And for every enzyme that I make, there's a code that tells my cells how to make that enzyme. If one of the letters in that code gets swapped out by spontaneous mutation to a different letter, that's called a single nucleotide polymorphism. A SNP means you got one letter wrong. Now, sometimes those SNPs mean the enzymes work better, and that's called evolutionary advantage. The vast majority of time, those single nucleotide SNPs work less effective. Okay? So, there are some things that I've managed to learn here. SNPs involving how we metabolize sulfur are actually quite common. About 20% of us have a SNP. So that means that there's a lot of variation of how well you handle sulfur in your cell's metabolism. And people who don't handle sulfur very well have a much higher incidence of osteoarthritis. They have osteoarthritis. And then they also, I discovered, they have more Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, motor neuron disease. So the brains begin to rot a little bit too early. Okay. This is, maybe I've got a sulfur problem. I can't go back. Okay. Back on that previous slide, there's also similar SNPs involving the vitamin B metabolism. And we have a whole host of vitamin Bs. They all do critical things in the brain. And we know that 20% of us have SNPs involving those vitamin B pathways. Now, one of the ways you can overcome that problem is to take a high-potency B vitamin, like a B50 or a B100. And if someone has a family history of mental health problems and heart disease, there's a high probability that they may have a SNP involving how their cells handle B vitamins and how their cells handle sulfur. Okay, so what I did, I took some sulfur amino acids, and this is a list of what some of those are, and I did methylfolate, methylcobalamin, and I took a B-complex vitamin series. I chose the methyl vitamins just in case I had that SNP that completely knocked out how I handled those two vitamins. Okay, mitochondria, they are so cool. That's why we are not bacteria. If you didn't have a mitochondria, you'd have to live as a bacteria, bottom line. So you got to love your mitochondria. And they make the energy that powers everything, all the chemical reactions of your life. And to make that energy, they use riboflavin and niacinamide, B2 and B3. So if you got a poopy mitochondria, taking high dose riboflavin, 200 milligrams, has been shown to help out poopy, lazy, ineffective mitochondria. So I started taking 200 milligrams of riboflavin. Niacinamide, thank you. is also another important vitamin. Coenzyme Q is another part of the pathway that those mitochondria use. Okay, we're all toxic. This is a study that's shown that over 480 toxic compounds that were checked for in human cord blood and in breast milk, over 200 were found, and that's the list. Many of those compounds have been banned for decades. I've also looked at the water quality in the state of Iowa from 1980 to 2008. About a third of our wells are contaminated with some sorts of some level of organophosphates, metabolites of atrazine and aliquor, and then we have about 20% of it contaminated with some type of heavy metal. Now, I'll tell you, those are things that brain cells do not like. And this is an excerpt that there's more evidence that disordered heavy metal metabolism are found in brain disorders. So if you got somebody who's got a bad brain, psychologically or neurologically, the likelihood that they've been accumulating toxins is high. Okay, so this is a complicated slide that reviews how you get rid of those toxins. This is more manageable. I'll summarize it for you. It's green leaves and bright colors and sulfur-containing vegetables. Let me say that again. Green leaves, bright colors, and sulfur-containing vegetables. You also need a lot of iodine, particularly to get rid of the heavy metals. Since I'm an Iowan, I don't eat that stuff. I went out to the co-op, got some powdered kelp, and I put a teaspoon to a tablespoon of powdered kelp whenever I'm cooking something. You know, interesting enough, when I started doing that, my family said, "Oh my God, Mom, that is the best. That is just like the best broth. That was the best casserole." And I'm thinking, okay, we're all deprived of some trace minerals that were coming back in that kelp. And then to stimulate the enzymes to get rid of trash, sulfur-containing vegetables in bright colors. And bright colors can be beets, red cabbage, red peppers, watermelon, berries, grape juice. Okay, this is sort of a little too tough scientifically here. If you're low on sulfur, your brain is more likely to get too much glutamate, and too much glutamate kills brain cells. Sort of the bottom line. You need sulfur. You need sulfur for so many things in your body. In the drugs I prescribe, and I'm sure many of your clients are on these drugs to try and boost their GABA levels, so that's gabapentin, Lyrica, being some of the most common. You can also use foods to increase that GABA and stabilize things. And the food has to have sulfur in it. So it's another reason why we want people to eat more sulfur, more cabbage family vegetables, onion family vegetables, and mushrooms. The gut matters. If we can't absorb and digest your food, it doesn't get up to the brain. And furthermore, when you absorb the meal you just ate, all the immune cells in your gut will have to decide, molecule by molecule, is that food a friend, foe, or an innocent bystander? If it gets the interpretation wrong and revs up the army to attack those food molecules, you develop an autoimmune disease. Most important message in your gut is to remember that food is food, it's an innocent bystander, you have to eat it. When food gets confused for an invading microorganism, then you're likely to get an autoimmune disease. The previous slide also noted that proton pump inhibitors, one of the most popular drugs that are prescribed, reduce the acid content of the stomach, which interferes with absorption of minerals and protein digestion and adds to our micronutrient lack. Even if you're eating the food and you can't digest it, you have a problem. This is the concept of leaky gut. There's a lot of conversation that food allergies are not recognized. And food allergies to grain and dairy are far more common than we realize. And that's a sort of a long history of chronic, unexplained symptoms involving pain, mood, and a lot of achiness. Drives the patients crazy, drives the doctors and the therapist all crazy, because this person is so miserable, and we don't know why. Okay. Well, celiac disease is more common. That's a food, an allergy to wheat. The point I want to make is there are many case reports of wheat allergies associated with brain diseases. This is looking at ALS, Parkinson's disease, motor neuropathies, epilepsy, and these are case reports of MS-like conditions that resolve with complete removal of milk and grain. And this is just a flow diagram that explains the physiology of how food allergies can get you into trouble. Yeah, and I'm going to sort of blow through this. If you eat too much grain, you get the wrong kind of bacteria in your gut. Those wrong bacteria that our species is unfamiliar with can secrete molecules that diffuse into our bloodstream that stimulate inflammation, the attack response, and are associated with an autoimmune-like response. Grains and sugars are recent to our species, and they're associated with germs that are more likely to be hostile. Greens, colors, meats, and avoidance of grain are more likely to have gut bacteria that our species is familiar with. I'm going to skip this one for us. So bottom line, organic sulfur, onions, broccoli, kale, mushrooms are essential. The intensive directed nutrition that I created for myself is 9 cups of fruits and vegetables. I have about 6 cups of sulfur-containing vegetables, 3 cups of bright colors, 1 to 2 teaspoons of kelp and algae every day. I use grass-fed meat and fish oil for the omega-3s, and I completely eliminated grains, dairy, and eggs. Those are the supplements that I took, which are stressing to be vitamins, sulfur amino acids, and vitamin B. I'm sure you know that vitamin D insufficiency is epidemic, particularly in Iowa. This is a complicated flow diagram that explains the physiology of everything that I was doing. So I was improving my ability to make nerve growth factors. I was decreasing the inflammation by getting rid of the grain and dairy. I was improving my ability to get rid of the trash by adding the kelp, algae, sulfur, and brightly colored foods. And this is a summary that lets you know I got dramatically better over the following 6 months once I started these interventions. I think this says it all. In 2 years, I went from being in a total climb wheelchair to doing a trail ride between the Rockies. I'm still not normal. My kids will definitely attest to that. Standing for a long time is fatiguing. Walking is still fatiguing. But what is remarkable is that, yes, I can walk. And when the weather is good, I can bike 5 miles into work. We have a planned prospective study to test these interventions. As I certainly have to disclose, my observations are based on my interpretation of the physiology literature, my own experience, and I've not been able to test these fully in others. What I do in my clinical practice is I work with people to fix the starvation. I stress replacing the grains and dairy with fruits and vegetables. I think about whether or not we should use B-complex vitamins, a multivitamin mineral, how to get omega-3s, either the fish oil or flax oil, and talk about reducing vegetable oil intake in fried foods. I stress the micronutrients. Talk about toxic load, if people can afford it. Growing their own food is really the best strategy, even if it's just a pot on the windowsill or on the porch. Growing green leaves is the best nutrition you can get. Then growing sulfur, cabbages, onions are also very easy to grow and powerful good for you. Iodine trace minerals, seaweed and algae you can get in bulk, and a teaspoon a day will go a long way. The algae, I would start with an 1/8 teaspoon a day, a bunch of soy milk and a banana, and work your way up from that. Reducing allergens is sometimes appropriate. That's a bigger conversation with my patients. and we talked about a elimination diet. Again, these are sort of the summary of what's going on and why with your interventions. And an overview of the concepts. What I was trying to do was correct the physiology and the process, what we call functional medicine. I also am a conventional medicine doc, and I still diagnose, treat, and control symptoms. But I find in my clinics, as I try to address the physiology by improving nutrition, I get superior results, but simply controlling symptoms. Okay, these are the many, many people that have helped me design the prospective study, which is in front of the IRB, and I anticipate, with good luck, being able to begin enrolling people this spring. And I think that's the show. So, we have some time for questions.
I have one.
Yes.
What would a daily meal consist of for you? I mean.
Okay, so the question is, what on earth do you eat every day? I have a hard time imagining. So I get up in the morning, I'll make a smoothie using soy milk, banana, and about a half teaspoon of algae. I put in a couple teaspoons of cinnamon and a variety of other fun spices. I also put in my sulfur amino acids, and I blend that. Some days I want it hot, and so I'll brew some yerba mate or green tea and put that in. So I'll have about 3 cups of smoothie. In that, there are probably about 16 grams of protein. Then I go off to work. I'll have probably 4 cups of greens, and that might be spinach, kale, collards, romaine lettuce, with a bunch of garlic, ginger, 2 tablespoons of hemp oil or flax oil, and a tablespoon of lime juice or lemon juice. Shake it all up, eat that. I will also have an apple, orange, carrots, rutabaga, some other raw stuff to munch on as well. And I may have a small piece of chicken or beef in the salad as protein. If I do, it's no more than 2 ounces. I'll come home, and I'll have another plateful of greens, so that's probably another 3 cups. I will have a cup of bone broth, and then I'll have whatever meat or protein source that we're going to have that evening. And typically I'll have a smaller smoothie of soy milk and algae and cinnamon in the evening as well. At that time it'll only be maybe 1 to 2 cups. And if I'm hungry again before evening, before I go to bed, I'll have some nuts. So when I work with my patients, you know, a lot of folks say, my God, my patients would never do that. My clinical practice is in a traumatic brain injury clinic. So people come in with mild to moderate traumatic brain injury and significant psychological problems, huge social functioning difficulties. And I have data now about 185, 190 patients. The mean vegetable intake, food intake is 1.4. I have half an hour to do the exam, talk with them, teach them about nutrition and brain health. Tell them that they need 9 cups, 3 to 6 sulfur, 3 colors, no white potatoes until you've had 9 cups. And talk about iodine, talk about omega-3s. At the end, I say, okay, tell me what you learned, and tell me what your goals are. And the bottom line is, the mean goal right now is 7.4. I plan to certainly have people go from 0 to 3, and I give them huge praise for that, because that's a phenomenal goal. But I've since learned that the problem, the reason people don't change their diet, is that we, as healthcare practitioners, haven't changed their diet. We haven't experienced the visceral transformation that food can provide. And we as a species, we've learned how to read nonverbals long before you know how to talk. And so if the person talking with me hasn't really experienced and doesn't fully understand the benefit of food and taking care of themselves, then of course I'm not going to follow any nutritional suggestions they make. But when they do, and they convey that pretty clearly, people, I can think of 6-7 individuals in 2 years that have not made a significant dietary change. More questions, please. Yes?
Sulfur amino acids.
Okay, so there's a whole host of amino acids that contain sulfur in them. Things like taurine, N-acetylcysteine, MSM, SAMe, glucosamine sulfate. Now, the hazard of sulfur amino acids is that most of these supplements are now made in China. And you probably remember the milk powder scandal and the kids that died in China. So if you're going to buy supplements, I would have people get their supplements from someplace that's certified with good manufacturing practices. So there's third-party testing to know that there's no heavy metals and crap and other bad things in them.
So if you're eating red meat, do you get sulfur in your essence?
No. You'll get some, but not enough. So you want to eat cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, kale is fabulous. Because it has sulfur and it's green, so it has the B vitamins. And it has lots of minerals. And if you don't like sulfur salad, or probably the kale salad, you can steam it for a minute and then mince it up. The bitterness is entirely gone. The other thing I do is if you put it in the lime juice for an hour or two, that also predigests it a little bit. It's not as quite as tough and fibrous. Although my kids really like it steamed, so I've been doing more of that for their salad. Mine, I still take it raw. Other questions?
You progress from organic versus non-organic.
Sure.
So assimilation rates, how we know we're actually assimilating the food we're taking in.
Okay, so first comment is, can I address organic and can I address assimilation or digestion? There's no question that current farming practices engage huge amounts of pesticides, herbicides, and that's incorporated in the plant. Now, you can carefully wash the plants and get off any surface pesticides. But if you want to reduce your pesticide exposure, you can go to Environmental Working Group, and they have a wonderful website that lists the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. And they update that with their testing every year because it changes. So that's a good resource. Growing your own is a good resource. Going to your local farmers and buying the organic things grown sustainably. Don't assume what's in the farmer's market is necessarily organically grown. You have to be sure and inquire. I'd be very careful about the meat as well, because all of the meat has all these hormones in it, so I'd be cautious about that. Assimilation, there are a variety of nutritional assays that can be done to look at how well you're assimilating food. Part of the challenge is that's not been a validated process. Insurance companies aren't going to pay for it. And you have a hard time finding physicians familiar with those kind of assays. But yes, it is possible. If you find a functional medicine doc, they would probably be familiar with that. And to find a functional medicine doc that thinks that way, you can Google the Institute for Functional Medicine, and you have to navigate around their website. There is a place where you can put in your zip code and find functional medicine providers within 50 miles or within 100 miles. And it does have international providers as well. If you're on a PPI, the assumption would be you're not digesting your food very well. Okay. Oh, so actually I have a bit more time. I didn't have to quite go so fast. Okay, well, I'm going to fill in one slide then that I bypassed. There's new evidence that in MS, there are these chronic plugs in the veins that drain the brain. And very hot, new, exciting research. This was, and there was a prospective study where they went with the Roto-Rooter, cleaned out those plugs, and people did significantly better. The bottom line I take from that is when you have a lot of inflammation cytokines, it begins to clog up vessels. The MS, it clogs up the brain. If you have arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, other autoimmune problems, it will clog up vessels in your extremities. the vegetables that maximize how your mitochondria work also maximize and correctly modulate the enzymes that produce what we call inflammation cytokines or inflammation molecules, and that dials them back dramatically. So if you've got a problem that has an autoimmune component, you probably have a lot of inflammatory cytokines clogging up your blood, which is decreasing blood flow to your brain, to your extremities. Getting rid of the grain, getting rid of the dairy, eating sulfur vegetables, eating colors, will decrease the inflammation molecules and will improve flow to the brain, flow to the joints, make it easy for your body to get rid of all that crap that's been stored in the fat, and you do better. And people actually will. I'm putting a big push with the residents that we have to treat fruit and vegetable consumption like smoking. You need to bring it up every time. Say, you know, the goal is 9 cups. If you're completely healthy, maybe you can get by with 5. But if you're not completely healthy, the most important medicine I can give you is 9 cups of fruits and vegetables. You want to be sure that you're having green leaves, sure you're having sulfur, sure you're having color every time you eat. And when we make that message, people begin to make the changes. I also have a lot of questions about, like, man, how that's expensive eating that way. Yes, it is. And no, it's not. In my own personal case, you know, treating progressive MS is a very expensive disease. Tysabri is about $4,000 a month. The other ABCR drugs are about $2,000 to $3,000 a month. Neurostim, nowhere near that expensive. Fruits and vegetables, nowhere near that expensive. If I look back over the PC 2 years of my care before 2007 when I did these interventions, and then the cost since I started these interventions to now, I figure I'm probably ahead about $30,000. So, you know, when we eat cheap food, we're displacing cheap today for enormous costs tomorrow. Seaweed in the Asian stores, very inexpensive, dried seaweed. Dried mushrooms, very inexpensive. Organ meats there, very inexpensive, and are probably far more nutritious for us than plain red meat. So it's possible to get seaweed for your greens, possible to get dried onions, dried mushrooms, dried garlic, very inexpensively. Learning to use beans and rice for your protein, cooking with seaweed, mushrooms and garlic can be very inexpensive, far less costly than fast food and far healthier. Okay. Yes.
You said to avoid grain, but you just said beans and rice.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a contradiction there. So rice is probably the least allergenic of the grains. And if you're vegetarian, some beans and rice, you'll need some rice to complement the beans.
Is there a preference for white or basmati versus brown?
Brown. Wild rice would be fine too. And, you know, it's a whole lot easier to go gluten-free now. There are great websites for recipes and resources. You can find gluten-free bread mixes, pancake mixes. My family was a whole lot happier when I started doing that and letting them have that on occasion. I've also discovered that when my family goes off the diet and goes back to eating fast food or grains, they have headaches, asthma suddenly pops up in their face, dramatically breaks out. So it sort of reinforced better dietary choices. But they had to detox. It took them about several weeks to get to that point. Other questions? Yes.
When you're measuring, are we talking about raw?
Okay, so
packed down? Or
so here, 1 cup of vegetables. If you're using raw salad leaves, that would be equivalent to 2 cups. If you're using cooked spinach, that would be 1/2 cup. If otherwise, so you're doing broccoli or cauliflower, 1 cup is the same raw cooked. With my clinic practice, I generally say 9 cups, and if people are doing loosely packed spinach, it works better to have a simpler message with my patients. So 9 cups, green, sulfur, color at every meal. That's a simple enough message they can get their arms around. They come back multiple times, I can help refine that. Yes?
But you typically package the spinach as you see it, like chopped grocery store.
Sure. So a chopped, you can get chopped, the question has to talk about spinach a little bit more. So you can get chopped frozen spinach. It is probably 2 cups of chopped frozen spinach in that, maybe 4. I haven't measured one lately. But a half cup of that cooked, chopped, frozen spinach, that would be the equivalent of a cup of greens. And the hierarchy would be fresh, grow it yourself, fresh, eat it in the garden is probably best. Then soon out of the garden is next. Then fresh, frozen. Then stale, fresh. Then canned. Then none at all. And if you cook or have canned, remember the minerals, vitamins, everything that's water soluble is now in the juice. So if you pour any juice down the drain, you just poured 80% of your nutrition away. Now, I do have a website, terrywalls.com, and I have some books. I have some audio lectures, DVD lectures, and I actually have some of those today if anyone happens to be interested there. More questions, please.
Okay, I'm reluctant to bring this up because I can't really articulate the arguments for or against, but could you talk a little bit about soy?
Oh, sure. So the question is soy. I hear a lot of good stuff, bad stuff, negative stuff. The first thing I'll talk about is potential food allergens. There's a list of foods, the most common things to which we have allergies. Wheat is, and dairy is by far the most common, followed by eggs. Peanuts would come next. Soy comes in after that. The nightshade family, that whole family, which is peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, and potatoes, would come after that. If you've been eating food to which you're allergic, it's sort of like having a poison ivy rash on your leg, but set it on your bowels. So it's not working very well. It's not filtering foods out. So suddenly you're becoming sensitized down near everything that you eat. And if you go on an elimination diet, heal up your gut, then many of those sensitivities would go away. And there are circumstances where people are so ill, have such severe food allergies, they might need a more intensive elimination diet. A first place would be get rid of the 3 biggest offenders, and we'll see how you do. Some people do have allergies to soy. And they also would need to not consume the soy. In general, I think soy is fairly well tolerated, particularly the tofu, which we have an immense historical history. Now, the more recent textured soy products, textured protein, and soy milk don't have as much historical history, so I can't tell you exactly how safe those are. I use them. I enjoy them. The other caveat that worries me about soy and about all of our food is genetically modified food, which unfortunately no longer has to be, never had to be labeled. And as these genes are inserted, inserting a gene that lets the soybean plant manufacture its own pesticide means that there's less pesticides on the soy. But it also means that that same gene, when it eat it, is passing through your gut, and if some of your gut bacteria pick up that gene, now you have your own internal production of pesticides. Is that a health problem? I don't really know. My personal bias is I'd much rather eat food that has not been re-engineered. And unfortunately, I'd say about 80%, maybe more, of our soybean crop is now genetically engineered soybean. Same is happening to corn, and I believe rice. It's also happening to farmed fish. Has been genetically modified as well. Yes?
Is almond milk, coconut milk?
So if you look at soy milk, you have, I believe, about 12 grams of protein per cup. Soy milk will have about 2 grams of protein. Rice milk will have about 2 grams of protein. Tastes wonderful. It's a great option, alternative. I certainly enjoy that. There are some rice protein powders, soy protein powders, hemp protein powders if you want to get more protein. Certainly, I think there are some milk, non-dairy milk options that make the transition into going wheat-free, dairy-free far easier for more comfort. I was thrilled when I discovered this. I thought for a while, and I was like, oh my God, I can make milk again. And then I started, you know, making my sort of homemade frozen dairy, non-dairy dessert. That was fun. It's a big treat. Yes, please.
Is fresh or frozen always better than dry?
So the question is fresh or frozen always better than dry? It depends on the drying. And so the techniques for drying are variable enough that I can't give you a definitive answer. So drying fits somewhere between on the plant and not at all. And certainly, you know, if money is an issue, I wholeheartedly endorse going and investigating, getting the dried mushrooms, for example, dried seaweed. So there's so much nutrition in those two sets of foods. Yes. So the question is, what about miso? Is miso good? Yeah, miso is fine. Soy sauce is fine. For people who I've asked to be gluten-free, dairy-free, I ask them to read the label carefully to be sure that it's gluten-free. If people are gluten-sensitized, they will do much better if they really take the time to read labels and be very meticulous.
So
501?
About 3 minutes more.
Okay. I'm happy to continue talking. I know you guys may have other things to do, so I want to be respectful of your time constraints. Yes, please.
Have you noticed that with the patients that you're working with, that they've been able to reduce the amount of pharmaceutical drugs?
Oh, yes. So the question is, what's happening with the pharmaceutical drugs people require to follow my diet? Over a 2-year period, what I've seen is the medication needs steadily decline. Diabetic needs steadily decline, less insulin, people are coming off insulin. Lipid medication declines, mental health needs stabilize, and that's very consistent. And I've seen it over 2 years. I would also make the observation that all of you, we all have maintenance workers that are fixing up everything that's broken down in our bodies. If you're eating the standard American diet, you're fixing up the broken down stuff with more broken down molecules. If you're eating the Walls diet, which is 9 cups of green leaves, a lot of sulfur, a lot of bright colors, your maintenance workers are fixing up broken down molecules with correctly made molecules. And so I see people coming in looking steadily younger, blood pressure is falling, mood's improving, diabetic control improving, arthritis symptoms decreasing. And I'm completely convinced it's because their maintenance workers finally have the tools they need at hand to do the maintenance work. And I also hear from my patients that it becomes steadily easier the longer they're on this diet. They begin to be a little more responsive to the little signals their body gives us that, that food is really, really good. I want to be eating a lot more of that in response, which is very interesting, fun little sidebars. And yesterday I had a fellow call me up who had had severe fibromyalgia, belly pain, and a mild traumatic brain problem. And I gave him a wall sign. I said, I really got to try going gluten dairy free for a while. Called me up a week later, thanking me that this is the best he's felt in years. People, in fact, will make these changes. However, my strongest advice is you make the changes. You experience the differences. And then it will be far easier for you to convey this to your patients. If you can't make these changes to eat intently for health, why would A, your kids, and B, any of your clients? It really makes my residents very uncomfortable. I keep hammering that on them. Some of them get it, some of it just like, no. Any other questions? Well, that's a big unknown. That is a big unknown. Yeah, that very helpful thing we can do is eat locally. Go to your grocers and say, what are you getting locally? Eat in season. The stuff that's imported now to be fresh is often coming from countries that have very lax, have a very different set of standards for their pesticides and food safety. So eating local, and when it's winter, eat frozen. We do have more farmers that are putting in greenhouses to extend the growing of greens locally. Support them. Imported food, a lot of carbon footprint, a lot more risk. And if you buy local, we're infusing money back into our local economies, local farmers, which is exactly what I want to be doing.
What is asparagus
doing? Asparagus is rich in sulfur. Rich in sulfur. It's very good for you. And actually, so is red peppers. So asparagus was fabulous.
Extra virgin olive oil.
Well, I use very little olive oil. I use no commercial salad dressings. What I've discovered is, I make my salad, I go take some dried green herbs, basil, oregano, thyme, whatever, put a couple tablespoons of that on the salad, then I get an omega-3 oil. And so that could be walnut oil, flax oil, hemp oil, put a tablespoon or so of that on. Then I put a tablespoon or so of organic lime juice or lemon juice, or orange juice for that matter. And then I toss my salad. It's way cheaper than salad dressing. And instead of filling your body with omega-6s, because right now most of us have a ratio of about 45 to 1, omega-6 to omega-3. The ideal ratio would be 3 to 1. If you want to fix that, you have to get rid of all the omega-6s. So if you eat oils that are rich in omega-3, like hemp, flax, or walnut, there's plenty of enough omega-6 in those oils. And if you eat meat that eats grass or green algae, that will have a balanced omega-3, omega-6, and your omega-6 ratios will correct. If y'all did that today, you saw the light, you went home and you started fixing your omega-3 ratios, do you know how long it would take to fix the omega-3 ratio in your brain? This will be a little shocking. 7 years. So, I mean, let's start now. You don't have a lot of time. When you look at our kids, what our kids are eating, it's no wonder we have such an epidemic of autism, of learning disability, of aggressive behaviors, of depression. It's no wonder we have so many children. Their brains are on fire. Their brains don't have all the building blocks to make the appropriate chemicals. The most important medicine for our children is green leaves, bright colors, little seaweed, and omega-3s. And convincing them that white flour and sugar is rotting their brain and their penis. Yes.
Stevia has a
sweetener. You know, I don't have a strong opinion about that because I don't know enough. My preference is use cinnamon, cardamom, nutmeg, cloves, spices instead. When I make my smoothies, when I make my desserts, I discovered that by using those spices and a little bit, then you only need a little bit of honey because those spices have a little bit of heat to them. It cuts the bitterness dramatically. Your grandmother knew that. My grandmother knew that. They didn't need much sugar. We forgot that because high fructose corn syrup is so cheap. But, you know, so it's a transition. You know, a shock to my family is a little tough for them. So making transitions are helpful. And this is a journey. You have to go home, hopefully get fired up to start eating this way. And it will be bumps. I did not get to this point immediately. I modified my diet. It felt really pretty good. And I thought, well, you know, I really like pecan pie. I'm going to have one. Not the whole pie. I thought about it, though. And the next day, the joints in my right hand were red. I couldn't really close my fists. I felt miserable. I wasn't thinking so well. I revved up my narrow stem. I thought, okay, I could compensate. I couldn't. It took about a week to clear. But, you know, I'm so stupid, I did it again. After the third time, it's like, you know, it just doesn't look good anymore. So my family would be having other treats, and I'd just make another big kale salad. You know? They'd laugh.
Yes. What about foods packaged in plastic?
So the question is, what about plastic? Now, you guys will want to come at the New Pioneers hosting some lectures. I'm doing the obesity, starvation, addiction triad. The poisons in our food, and I'll talk about plastics then. And then the Walls Way, which is doesn't have all the science. It's just more, here are the things you can do to help protect your brain, the foods to eat, and the things to do. But if you come to the toxic lecture, you'll hear more about that. If you can, glass is better. Never microwave in plastic. Water bottles, stainless steel is better. Glass is better. There is some evidence that the plastics are leached into the water. They get into our system, and you have to get rid of them. And so what you want to do is minimize your intake. But we live in a toxic world. Crap's coming in. So I want to be sure that the floodgates are fully open to getting rid of the crap. So that is 9 cups of green leaves. You know, that'd be really good, but at least 3 cups of green leaves, 3 cups of sulfur, 3 cups of bright colors, and some seaweeds. You have plenty of iodine. Then you can get rid of the stuff. Now, I'd be thoughtful about your toxic exposures in terms of what you can do. I'd also make the observation that if you implement all of this at once, it may feel so completely overwhelming that you're discouraged. You know, do it incrementally. Decide, I'm going to have green leaves, bright color, and sulfur every time I eat. After I've eaten that, I can eat what I want. Then we get that part down, and you can move on to the next step. But I would take this in manageable bites. Yes?
Oh, we had too much white flour and sugar. Could you go through specifically sulfur?
Okay.
3 cups of sulfur. Break it down into
sulfur.
Real
foods.
Real terms.
Okay, so cabbage.
Okay.
You can take red or green.
Okay.
Slice off a big whack, put it in your lunch bucket, munch on raw cabbage during the day. You can take rutabaga, turnips, slice them up, munch on those. You can take cauliflower, broccoli, slice that up, bring it along. You can, garlic and onions are really fabulous. You can get them raw or cooked. Mushrooms, incredibly good for us. Just make sure you didn't get poisonous ones. But incredibly good for you. Asparagus and red peppers also have mushrooms. Also have sulfur. They could have mushrooms. Broccoli, yes. So the cruciferous family is huge. Anything in that family is really good for us. Mustard greens, wasabi. Very good for you. You're very welcome.